All right, so this is Bio 231, and your grades are up on Blackboard for you to check out. So, it all depends on what grade you have. I can't say if the class did really good on average or poorly on average. There's a whole range of grades, so congratulations if you got up in the 90s. That's really, really good. So quite a few students did, but if you're lower than that, then you should probably come talk to me and see if you're studying the right material and if you're studying the right amount of time, or maybe you're just cramming the night before or something like that. All right, so it all depends on your particular situation. So I can't really comment as a class as a whole. So maybe see me during office hours and we can look over different parts of the test and see if it was exam figures that was a problem for you or what, okay? But the only thing I do know is that nobody got 100% on the test. Some people came really close, but nobody got 100. So that could be you next time, and I hope it is you next time on the test, okay? All right, well, the computer's still booting up. I don't know if it's about ready to crash or not, but at least I have some pictures here, which is a good thing. So we are just slightly ahead of schedule. We're looking at some bones, and we talked about bone structure. Talked about how bones can be classified by their shape, and we also talked about the components of the skeletal system, because from now on, we're going to be talking about anatomy in terms of or at the organ system level, right? So we're looking at the skeletal system right now. And so what are the components of the skeletal system? Bones, that's one. That's yeah, cartilage and joints. Don't forget about cartilage and joints. And then there's one other thing. Okay, ligaments. Yes, ligaments. And what the heck is a ligament? Yeah, it is a kind of connective tissue that attaches bone to bone. And in particular, what kind of CT is it? Dense, regular CT, right. So maybe you can even have a picture in your mind of what dense, regular connective tissue even looks like histologically. All right, so we were looking at this slide last time. And remember, there are generally two kinds of bones that we can observe just in terms of its gross structure. And what are the two kinds of bones? Two forms of bony structures, or two forms of how bone is made. Spongy bone is one kind, and compact is another. And where would you find spongy bone? The epiphyses. Yeah, there's a lot in the epiphyses. But what maybe is a better way of thinking in terms of the location between compact bone and spongy bone? Okay, I'm not quite sure I heard anybody. Okay. Ah, spongy bone is inside the bone. I like that. Maybe some of you said that. I just didn't quite hear. But what is that when we say inside the bone, using anatomical language? Anatomical. It's deep. Spongy bone is deep, while compact bone is superficial. There's another way we can talk about it, too. Instead of being deep, we could say medullary bone. The medulla of an organ is the deep part of it, and bone is an organ because it contains blood and it contains nerves, right? So it has nervous tissue and connective tissue. So medullary bone is deep, while cortical bone is, superficial. Compact bone is cortical bone. I misspoke. Well, I was going to lead you through that, but you see what I mean. So compact bone is superficial or cortical bone, and it all goes by these same, it can go by any of those different terms, right? So cortical bone can be compact bone or superficial. Okay. One thing I didn't mention too much last time are these epiphyseal plates right here. Maybe I did mention it, but What is going on here? Why do we see this line going very close to the epiphyses? And we would see one down here in the distal epiphysis as well. What's happening at these lines right here? Yeah, another way of saying that is that is a growth plate. And in this particular bone, it looks like it's a mature bone because it looks like compact bone right here. But in an individual before puberty, it is a cartilaginous plate, so that the bone is actually growing in length at this region right here because it's cartilage, as well as from the distal epiphyseal plate. And what kind of connective tissue is sturdier and harder, can resist compression more? Bone or cartilage? Bone or cartilage? Bone, because bone is sort of like cement. It's very difficult to compress, but cartilage is a softer kind of tissue, and it can compress. And if, for instance, if there's a youngster growing up and this is a cartilaginous plate right here, right, it can be compressed and those chondrocytes can be damaged, and then the bone is going to stop growing at that location because the epiphyseal plate has been damaged. And if it's only one leg, for instance, then one leg will be shorter than the other. So compression injuries are common, but also twisting. All right, so compression is what? Pushing the ends of the bone together. Torsion is pulling the bones apart. And the twisting, anybody know what we call a twisting motion, a twisting force? That would be torsion. That would be torsion. So these long bones can be damaged by torsion too. If, for instance, we always like to tell young people if they're playing baseball not to throw any kind of funny balls, like curveballs, screwballs, and things like that, because they have to twist their arm to put a lot of spin on a baseball as they throw it. And that torsion can damage the epiphyseal plates as well. Yeah.
So if someone actually were to accidentally like sprain their ankle, what can be considered important as well?
Yeah, but not just on a long bone, the long axis of a bone, but that could be a ligamentous damage because there are a lot of ligaments in the ankle. So chances are it's not going to affect the bone very much, but ligaments that hold the ankle together. You know, unless they pull off the bone, then that could damage the bone. But mostly it's just ligaments in the ankle. Okay, and that dense regular connective tissue that makes ligaments up, there's not a, it doesn't have a very high vascular supply. It's not very vascular, so ligaments have a tendency not to heal very well either. Once they get stretched out, because you overextend them, then they stay stretched out pretty much for the rest of your life. Okay, so that's one problem with an ankle injury. All right, so those are the epiphyseal plates. I think we talked about the different kinds of marrow. What are the different kinds of marrow?
Yellow.
Yeah, yellow and red. Yellow is, what's the function? Storage of energy. And what's the function of red bone marrow? It makes red blood cells. Right, makes red blood cells. All right, let's see if we have a Microsoft. Oh, we still don't have a Microsoft Word document. Oh, my goodness. Okay, let's see if I can maybe reload it or something. Oh, it's right there. Okay, great. Okay. Types of bone. So we're close to chemical composition of bone. Here is now a flat bone that's in the skull, and you can see the cortical bone is definitely compact, and there is just a very thin layer on the inside of spongy bone. Sometimes we call that diploe. All right, so that's even another name for spongy bone. And that might contain a little bit of red marrow, but mostly yellow marrow, but it's just not a very big area. Okay. Okay. So these bony plates that make up spongy bone, we call these trabeculae. And the trabeculae are arranged in such a way to resist the forces that are put on a bone. All right, so actually when you compress a bone, it sets up little electrical currents inside the bone. And actually this is just my supposition. I don't know if we have any scientific evidence that shows that, but when these little electrical currents develop within a bone, right, that tells the bone where to deposit calcium, the matrix that makes it stronger. Okay, so if you want to build nice strong bones, what do you really have to do to a bone? you have to stress it, right? You have to, of course, properly, right, after puberty, so exercise, right? So what are good ways that you can maintain good, healthy bones? It is exercise plus, just like everything else, nutrition or diet. So you need good calcium and phosphate in your diet plus vitamin D so that you can absorb that calcium. And bones are sort of an interesting topic in terms of pathophysiology because it is rare that a disease process will affect almost everybody in the population. I know a couple weeks ago, there was a bad cold that was going around, but did we all come down with that cold? No, a few of us did not. Actually, probably most of us didn't for this particular cold. So in a population, because we're a diverse population, we don't all come down with the same disease at the same time. That's one of the purposes of diversity, right? So we're a healthy population because of diversity. But here's a pathophysiology that will affect everybody as we grow older. And now I would like you to read my mind. What pathology is that? And it's pertinent to bones, that is osteoporosis, right? And osteoporosis just means the demineralization. As we get older, our body loses calcium and phosphate from bones, and they get brittle, and they can break, especially when we're in our 80s, and for sure in our 90s. And how would you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Diet and exercise. And typically, who suffers from this malady more than women or men?
Women.
And what's the reason for that? Okay. Yeah, it might be related to hormones like estrogen, especially postmenopausally, but men will lose bone density as well. But what can you tell me about the male bone structure on average compared to the female bone structure? Even maybe in your 20s or 30s. Men's bones are typically bigger and stronger, so as they lose bone density as they get older, it just doesn't affect them to the same degree or to the same rate as females, because females typically have smaller, daintier bones and can't afford to lose as much calcium. All right. But even if you're female and you're blessed with bigger, stronger bones, you're going to be less susceptible to osteoporosis compared to if you have a daintier skeletal system. You'll be the most susceptible to osteoporosis. But how can you protect yourself? And this has to be especially premenopausally, before menopause, is what? Diet and exercise. That's right. Stress those bones, because bones are not just like this concrete pillar that we see in the room right here. Bones are living structures, and every 5 years you have a complete whole new skeletal system. It's completely being rebuilt all the time. Okay, unlike these cement columns that once they're built, they just stay there. Okay? All right, so let's look at now the basic building block of compact bone. The basic building block of compact bone is what we call an osteon. So this circular structure is what we call an osteon. And in the very center of the osteon, we have an artery and a vein that's supplying blood to the bone. And there might even be some nerves in there. So bone is highly vascular. That has some good points and bad points. One bad point is that if a bone is broken, what's going to happen? It's going to hemorrhage, right? It's going to bleed. But once that bleeding stops, fortunately, hopefully it will. I've heard of people actually dying from blood loss as a result of broken bones. That certainly can happen. Okay, but if you're able to stop that initial bleeding, what's the good part about having a good vascular supply to bone, as opposed to ligaments and to cartilage? It will heal a lot faster, right? So in about 4 to 5 weeks, if that fracture is treated properly, it will heal. It might even be stronger than the original bone. All right, so this is the blood vessel that's in the central canal. So here is the central canal. Sometimes we call that a Haversian canal. So another name for this osteon right here sometimes is called the Haversian system. Haversian system. Now, what do you notice about this Haversian system? It has some structure that probably your eye can pick up. What is it? What does your eye pick up on this osteon right here, this Haversian system? Do you see some circles in there? Okay. Well, the osteon is built upon a very nice physical principle, and that is the principle of tubes. And tubes are very strong. They resist compression, right? So if you take the ends of a tube and try to press on it, even if you have a paper straw and press on it, it can withstand a lot of force. It's not going to compress, right? And so that's the beauty of this aversion system. It's not one tube, but what do you see? You see tubes inside of tubes, which makes it even stronger, right? So bones really don't compress very easily at all. So these tubes are what we call lamellae. And the lamellae, and as a matter of fact, change your notes a little bit, say concentric lamellae make up the osteon. Concentric lamellae. All right, so they're tubes inside of tubes. Because there's another lamella that you should be aware of. Right? In this compact bone, we see many osteons, but circling the whole bone on the outside is a big ring, is another big what? Tube. So not only is the bone tubes inside of tubes, but all these tubes inside of tubes are inside what? Even more tubes, right? And so I see maybe five or six other lamellae that circle the whole bone right on the cortex, right? And so these we call circumferential lamellae. So bone by its design is very, very strong. Okay. Okay, the outside is the circumferential, and the osteons are made with concentric lamellae. And if we look further, microscopically, at an osteon, we can see that it's not just solid matrix, but of course there has to be osteocytes. And where are these osteocytes located? In lacunae, little pits within the bone. And that doesn't make the bone any weaker, because these osteocytes are always monitoring the state of the bone, making sure that it's healthy. And nutrients have to move from the blood supply, which is in the central canal, to these osteocytes. And nutrients and oxygen, and these cells need oxygen as well, and they need to get rid of CO2 because they're undergoing metabolism. But materials like that can't diffuse through a solid material. Like things can't diffuse through this desktop right here. If we spill something on this desktop, right, it's just going to sit right on the surface. Can't move through. So the way that material moves through the whole bone is via these little canaliculi. These aren't fractures, but these are little passageways. And the osteocyte probably even projects into these canaliculi so that material can diffuse from the central canal from one lamellae to the next via these, what are these little structures? Canaliculi, right? So they're filled with cells, with living osteocytes. Okay. All right, so the outer membrane right here is what we call the periosteum. And don't forget, lining every surface, inside surface of a bone, lining every little surface in the medullary cavity is another membrane. What do we call that membrane? That's the endosteum, right? All right, so this is how a bone grows in diameter. We learned that a bone grows in length at what two locations? The epiphyseal plates, when they're cartilage, right? The epiphyseal plates. But a bone also has to grow in diameter. And the bone grows in diameter because there are cells right here that lay bone, the new bone matrix down, and the endosteum, on the other hand, has a different kind of cell that breaks bone down. Because if those cells didn't break bone down, what would be the form of a bone? It would just be solid, and it would be heavy, and you wouldn't have that place to manufacture red blood cells or store energy. All right, so the cells that build the new bone matrix are called osteoblasts. So osteoblasts typically we would find in the periosteum, right on the surface of the bone. And another kind of bone cell that is associated with the endosteum are what we call osteoclasts. So now you know three kinds of cells. And what is the kind of cell? What is the kind of bone cell that we see in mature bone that's neither being broken down or built up? The osteocyte. Where do you find those guys? In lacunae, that's right. And the osteoblasts you're going to find primarily, okay, in the periosteum and osteoclast, primarily in the endosteum. That's a nice way to think of this. But you might find, of course, some osteoclasts in the periosteum, kind of just hanging out because you never know when that bone is going to break. And when it breaks, those osteoclasts have to get busy and work to remove those bone fragments. So there's always some population. All right, but on balance, osteoblasts in the periosteum, osteoclasts in the endosteum. And another good reason why a bone is hollow, and that is to maintain its tubular nature. And a tube, this is not very intuitive, but the strength of a tube, I don't know if there's any mechanical engineers in here, it's not intuitive, but a tube gets stronger and stronger and stronger as the wall gets thinner and thinner and thinner. And you could prove mathematically if the wall was to become infinitely thin, that tube would be infinitely strong in terms of compression. All right, so the thinner the tube is, the stronger it is in terms of compression. But that doesn't always mean a lot, because what happens if you apply some force to the side of that tube and it's very thin? Then it's going to snap that way. So I'm just talking about compression. All right, so there's a balance that your body has to go through. Okay. So here is a nice micrograph that you've been tested on already. There you can see the haversion system. Okay. All right, so here we see some concentric lamellae. And let's talk about the different kinds of components that we have in bone. Okay, so here are the three cells, the osteoblast. Maybe you made some notes what they're good for, and the osteocyte and osteoclast. And these cells also secrete collagen into the matrix. All right, collagen is real important because it resists a couple different kinds of forces. All right, collagen is what? Those fibers. And fibers resist what? Stretching. You can't stretch these collagen fibers, but if you have a collagen fiber, you can compress it. It's just like a thread. It compresses. All right, so collagen is real important because it can resist stretching. So bones can't stretch very much either because they have what material in them? Collagen. They have a lot of collagen. But the collagen is arranged in a very special way. And let's take a look at this picture right here. All right, so here we see some collagen fibers that are laid down in the matrix. Here's the first lamellae. Here's the second one. What can you tell me about the orientation of the collagen fibers? They're longitudinal. They're along the long axis of the bone, so the bone can't stretch. But what else do you see? They are aligned in opposite directions, so they crisscross each other, right? So that imparts some important strength to the bone. That reduces or absorbs the twisting motion. That prevents twisting of the bone. And so what force do we call twisting? That's torsion. All right, so the bone can't twist because of the collagen fibers right here. And collagen, remember, is an organic compound. It's almost like it's like a protein. And so there are protein fibers in bone to resist stretching and torsion, or tension and torsion. All right, and what else does the bone do? You can't stretch a bone, you can't twist a bone, but can you compress a bone? You can't, because it's got another kind of compound in there. The collagen doesn't resist compression, but what else does the bone matrix have that can resist compression? It's got calcium ions and inorganic phosphate. That's really like the cement that's put into the matrix. So bone can resist what? Tension, torsion, and compression. Oh, here we go. Compression right here. So the inorganic components, namely the calcium and phosphate, provides for hardness and they resist crushing. That's compression. But the organic part of bone, right, namely the collagen, resists the other two kinds of forces. So bone has these different components. When they're added all together in the right fashion, makes a really nice strong bone that can resist all of these different kinds of forces. All right, so what's the general and specific components of a bone that resist torsion? What can resist torsion? The chemical that resists torsion. Collagen, right? And that's generally what kind of compound? Organic or inorganic? That's organic. What about compression? What resists compression? Oh, the tube in a tube. Yep. But in terms of the actual chemical, the tube in tube is a very important concept. But what chemical can resist compression? It's the calcium and phosphate, right? And is that organic or inorganic?
Inorganic.
And then the last one is tension. What's the chemical compound that can resist tension? Collagen. Is that organic or inorganic again? Organic. So those are some typical kinds of considerations that you could see on a lab quiz or the test in here, right? How to appreciate these things. Okay. The active ingredient are combinations of calcium and phosphate, and this ratio right here, we call that hydroxyapatite. And the hydroxyapatite is the chemical compound that gets broken down as we get older. That's what your bone loses. Hydroxyapatite, and that's both what? Calcium and phosphate. Okay, I don't think that's in your book, but you should probably just know that anyway. Yeah, the active compound that's in bone, in the bone matrix, is hydroxyapatite. And hydroxyapatite is both a combination of calcium and phosphate, right, in this proportion right here. And I guess it's important for you to know that bones, one of the functions of bones was a reservoir, a storage area. What is it a storage area of? It is a storage area for calcium, not only for energy in yellow bone marrow, but bones are a storage form of calcium. And you need calcium for a number of really important reasons in your body. You can't contract a muscle without the right level of calcium in your blood. You can't even think any kind of thoughts at all without the proper level of calcium in your blood. So your body realizes that about the last place where you need proper levels of calcium is in bones. So that's why, as we get older, that's one of the reasons why we sacrifice our bones to maintain blood calcium levels so that what our heart can beat, so that we can breathe and think and things like that. All right, so that's one of the reasons for osteoporosis. Yeah. Yeah. If you pop your fingers, like joints and things like that, are you releasing calcium? Probably not. Probably not. Because when you pop your fingers, as a matter of fact, I might go the other way. If you pop your fingers, you're doing what? You're stressing those bones in there a little bit, not drastically. You're mostly working with the ligaments and tendons that do that. But you're still stressing the bones. And when you stress a bone, which way is calcium going to go? Is it going to come out of the bone or go into the bone? When you exercise a bone, calcium is going to go in to make it stronger, right? So that's the beauty of exercise premenopausally for women that need to protect themselves from osteoporosis. Yeah? Say what? Oh, see me after class. See me after class. Don't lose that thought. I couldn't quite pick it up. Okay. All right, so what is the basic building block of compact bone? It's the structural and functional unit of compact bone. It's called the osteon or Haversian system, right? I always like to emphasize building blocks or structural and functional unit of something. So throughout the class, I'm going to ask you what is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, or the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction. And the structural and functional unit of compact bone is the osteon, right? So you can use that, invoke the osteon to explain a lot about bone without having to get into the details, as long as the people that you're talking to know what an osteon is, right? So it's a model of how to think about why bone is so strong. All right, bone formation. Well, let me just look at these slides right here. Bone formation. Oh, what do we have right here? Yeah, we just have spongy bone. Okay, osteocytes. Okay. All right, so bone formation and growth. We talked a little bit about this already, but there are two general ways that bone can grow. Okay, there can be intramembranous ossification. What does this term ossification really mean? It means It means hardening. It means deposition of that hydroxyapatite matrix, all right, into bone, making it hard. Or there can be endochondrial ossification. So ossification is the formation of bone. Intramembranous ossification is important for you to know about, because some bones develop from, well, actually, all bones develop from a model, a precursor that is not bone. With a couple of examples, maybe like sesamoid bones. Does anybody remember what a sesamoid bone is? Yeah, that's a good example. The patella is a good example of a sesamoid bone. But a sesamoid bone is a bone that forms within a tendon or a ligament. All right, and there are some normal cases where sesamoid bones develop, and then there are some pathological conditions where sesamoid bones can develop, and they're very irritating, and sometimes you have to do something about that to reduce the irritation. Okay, but in most cases, bones are built where there is some kind of previous structure that is an outline or a template for what that bone should eventually look like. And there are two different kinds of templates. There could be a membranous template, which means a membrane. So if there's a membrane, what kind of bone, by its shape, do you think a membranous bone is going to form? Like a flat bone, right? Okay. And then there are other bones that develop from cartilaginous models and or templates, and we call that process endochondrial ossification. Most of the bones in your body have developed via the endochondrial ossification model, but there's a few from the membranous ossification. Most bones of the skull, because most bones in the skull are kind of what? Flat in nature, right? All right, so in intramembranous ossification, you have osteoblasts, because these are the kinds of cells that lay bone down, right, within the matrix of the membrane. Right, and then these osteoblasts automatically convert themselves into osteocytes after they're completely surrounded by bone. So at birth, these bones are not completely formed, especially in the skull. Right, and those joints between bones that are not ossified are called fontanelles. And I probably have a picture of a fontanelle someplace. In lab, you have to know a couple names of fontanelles. Commonly, I think probably everybody knows these structures. They're called soft spots. But probably what you don't know is, in a typical individual, how long they last for. Okay? They could last up to 2 years. And so that newborn is not protected, right? They don't have a nice strong cranial vault to protect their brain. And so that cranium can be damaged very easily for up to 2 years. Not just puncture wounds, but shaking or twisting or any kind of trauma like that. Right? And what's an advantage of having fontanelles in a newborn? Yeah, for birth, for instance, right? So the infant can move down through the birth canal, which is pretty narrow, so the head has to squish a little bit. But also the brain, right, develops very rapidly in the first couple of years, and faster than bone can develop. And so that just allows for expansion and normal development of the neonate brain as well. Oh yeah, it says movement and growth, two important things. I just kind of say in passing that there's a little dog that has fontanelles their whole life. Anybody know a little this kind of a dog that has fontanelles their whole life? That you, yeah, Chihuahua, you have to be kind of careful of. I like to have Dobermans at home, and I thought it'd be really cool to have like big Dobermans with little Chihuahuas playing with each other. And then I thought, oh wow, you know, if these little Chihuahuas have fontanelles their whole life, that might not be such a good idea, because just by horsing around, a Doberman could just crunch that little head too easily. Okay, so that's intramembranous ossification. I think the only example, exception to the rule, I think the clavicle is made out of intramembranous ossifications as well, and that's a long bone. So that's sort of an interesting exception to the rule. Oh, so all bones below the head, except for the clavicles, develop via endochondrial ossification. That means that there is a cartilaginous model that's built that is a template for what the real bone should look like before it becomes ossified. And that's hyaline cartilage. And the cartilage model is ossified in stages, All right, so we have a primary ossification center and a secondary, and let's just go and take a look at some pictures. All right, so here is the hyaline cartilage model of a long bone. It's some kind of typical long bone that's going to develop in your body. And the primary ossification centers, right, are in the endosteum that are surrounding this hyaline model right here. And it forms a collar all the way around the bone. So we call that the formation of a bone collar. And bone, it starts to ossify in this region over here. All right, and then the collar kind of fuses together, and then there are osteoclasts on the inside of the bone that start to hollow out the bone from the inside. And at about that time, we have a nice nutrient vessel that feeds nutrients and oxygen to the bone that is forming. All right, but see, we don't see any ossification centers in the epiphyses yet. All right, so at about this stage right here, we have a secondary ossification center that begins on the inside of both of these epiphyses, and it starts to grow, and it grows and it grows and it grows until these two ossification centers merge right on the epiphyseal plate. All right, and now this epiphyseal plate doesn't ossify completely until what time? What time in somebody's life does this epiphyseal plate turn into hot, solid bone? That's at puberty. Yeah. Osteoblasts. And there are osteoblasts in the secondary ossification center as well. All right. But in this developing medullary cavity on the inside, and even in this area deep inside the secondary ossification center, you have some osteoclasts as well, breaking down bone and making spongy bone in these locations. Okay, so you can see how bone grows in diameter from the endosteum, the osteoblasts in the endosteum. All right. And then from here on out, after the secondary and primary ossification centers merge and form the epiphyseal plate, this is where the bone grows in length from then on, at these epiphyseal plates. So bone growth and maintenance of bone, even in the adult, is a balance between two different kinds of cells. What's it a balance of? What two cells are always in balance or should be in balance with each other? The osteoblasts, which are building bone up, and osteoclasts that are breaking bone down. So this is continuously happening in your body so that every 5 years you have a complete new skeletal system. So I think you can appreciate how easy it is to have just a little bit of a mismatch after a certain period of time, especially postmenopausally. The osteoclasts are a little bit more active than the osteoblasts, and you have a tendency to lose bone density as a result of that, right? So there's a little imbalance between the blastic activity and clastic activity. So here is just a nice typical picture, okay, of what kind of process? Well, this looks like cartilage right up over here. Okay, hyaline cartilage to me. So, and then I see some denser bone, some ossification taking place down over here. I'm not sure I see any osteons in this region right here. But, so what kind of process is happening here? What kind of ossification would this be? Don't forget, how many processes did we learn? Two, the membranous via endochondrial. So what kind is this? Okay, but I see cartilage right here, so I wouldn't want to say intramembranous. I would want to say endochondrial ossification. Okay, so this would be an example of endochondrial ossification that we'd see in a typical kind of long bone. Okay. I don't think I'll talk about that slide very much. The only other interesting thing, maybe just in passing, this osteoclast right here, we can see it dissolving the bone matrix down. And don't forget, what balances out the activity of this osteoclast is the osteoblasts, right? So this is a very normal process. This osteoclast is a huge cell, right? It is composed of numerous cells that have come together, and we see what? Many nuclei inside this osteoclast. So it's just a big cell that can dissolve a lot of bone down. So it's interesting that even our cells can fuse together to form a single huge cell to perform a certain kind of job. Okay. All right, and appositional growth of bone is by addition of bone tissue to its surfaces, like in what, the primary ossification center? While the interior part of the bone is being degraded by osteoclasts. So that's a typical model for appositional growth. So we said bone is being remodeled all the time. Osteoclasts break bone down. Osteoblasts are building bone up. And so this is a process that happens, for instance, when a bone is fractured. These cells have to get busy. What's the nature, what's the physical property of a fractured bone? If you have bone fragments in your body, what's that like? Okay, it's painful, but if you're going to then slide a nerve over a broken bone or a muscle or something, what's going to happen to that bone and muscle? It's going to get lacerated, right? Because bone fragments are very sharp and they're hard, these other soft tissues, right? Then will get damaged. So how does your body protect itself from bone fragments after a fracture? Who gets busy? What kind of cell goes in there, gets busy, and gets rid of these bone fragments? It's the osteoclasts break the bone fragments down and remove them. And that also does another thing. When those bone fragments are broken down, what does that provide to the cells that build bone up? Calcium and phosphate, right, plus the other organic chemicals that are necessary, namely the building blocks of collagen as well. All right, so osteoclasts break down those bone fragments and provide building blocks for the osteoblasts to deposit a new bone matrix, and that process takes about 4 to 6 weeks. And there's a vitamin that's necessary to build collagen fibers. Anybody know what that is? It used to be a really big secret, probably not so much anymore. Like if you ever sprain your ankle and you go see a physician or somebody, nowadays they pretty much tell you, you should take this vitamin. What vitamin do you need to maintain dense regular connective tissue and dense irregular and even bone? Because bone contains a lot of collagen. So any place where you need collagen, you need this vitamin so that you can build new collagen. Okay, and that's vitamin C. Right, vitamin C is necessary for your body to build collagen. So if you ever sprain a finger, ankle, or anything like that, you should probably take a little extra vitamin C just to be safe. And is vitamin C very toxic?
No.
It is not toxic. You can take, well, at some level, I'm sure it is. If you ate vitamin C tablets all day long, it probably would not be good for you. But typically, there's a high safety margin because your body excretes vitamin C daily. It's water soluble, so you just lose it from your body when you void urinary bladder. So that's a good reason why you should have a daily supplement when your body needs to rebuild collagen, because your body can't store vitamin C. You just lose it so quickly. It's also an antioxidant. This is true, and that's why it's used in that oxidation reduction reaction to make collagen. Yeah. Well, if it gets flushed right out, I don't know what you mean by that, but there are certain, like vitamin D, yeah, needs factors for you to absorb from your gastrointestinal tract. Okay, vitamin C, on the other hand, is not that way. You can absorb pretty much all the vitamin C that you take, but you can't store it, so as much as you take, right, as soon as you void, you're going to lose a lot of it. Oh, you know, that's really good. I think you're going to have to take a physiology class and learn a little, or take some physical chemistry, and I always recommend taking a little bit of chemistry before a physiology class, because you'll learn some basic natures about molecules, and depending on their basic nature, whether they're hydrophilic or hydrophobic will determine if they're toxic or not toxic. Okay, and they're toxic because your body can hold on to them. Non-toxic kinds of vitamins or chemicals are those that your body will lose very easily because they dissolve in water as opposed to lipid. Yeah. So, I mean, that's all very interesting consideration. Yeah.
So, if you eat things that are like rich in vitamin C, that's better than...
That's good. You know, I'm not sure anybody really knows that for sure, but I would say a natural diet is probably better than... I would say if you have a well-balanced natural diet, you probably do not need to take vitamins. Okay? But it's really hard to maintain that all the time. Okay? So vitamins, as long as you don't take too many of the lipid-soluble vitamins, will give you a little breathing room in case you eat McDonald's French fries all the time. Okay? Okay? Okay. So bone repair. So once a bone is broken, of course, the broken blood vessels have to form a clot first, a blood clot, so that you don't bleed to death. After 2 to 3 days, a callus is formed, and that callus is just a fibrous network, mostly collagen, that's laid down, and it kind of glues all of the bone fragments together and the broken bones together, so that reduces abrasion, and it prevents additional damage in that particular tissue. All right, so the callus is a fibrous network, and cartilage is also deposited in that area after 3 days. And the collagen holds all these different fragments together. Okay, now after about 3 or 4 days, and the callus is formed before it's ossified, now that's sort of a dangerous time for that fracture. Because if the callus gets damaged during this period of time, then the bone is not going to heal normally. And it's going to take odd shapes, and it won't be strong. And so typically when you have a fracture, how do we protect it? Especially during this initial period right here. It's casted, right? So that you don't re-injure that fracture while the callus is formed before it can become ossified. All right, so then those osteoblasts enter the callus, deposit a new bone matrix, and then in 4 to 6 weeks, that bone is, if treated properly when it's a callus, is stronger than it was before. So that's usually a good thing. Who's ever broken a toe in here? Oh, I'm so sorry. It seems like, you know, toes aren't very important, but are toes important?
Yes.
Yeah, because you can't walk without them. And, of course, if you have a broken toe, what should you do to make sure that toe heals normally and gets strong again? You have to stay off your feet. They say bed rest for 4 to 6 weeks. All right, well, who can afford bed rest for 4 weeks or 6 weeks? Nobody can, right? Because you all have to go to school, go to work, kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So typically for parts of the body, parts of the skeleton that you cannot give a rest to, it's going to take longer than 4 to 6 weeks, and you got to be really careful you don't injure that toe while it's healing again, okay? Because it will even take longer, and then the toe will look weird, okay? Because it won't grow back normally. The only bone that's sort of interesting in terms of fractures that we're not really concerned about, there's a bone that breaks fairly frequently, and we hardly do anything with it once it's broken. It's impossible to cast, and that is the clavicles right here. And when we get to the skeleton, I'll kind of show you why it breaks so easily. It breaks in a really nice way, but when it is broken, we just like to leave it there, and what do you end up with? Usually a very jagged clavicle right there, okay? So that's just one kind of exception. I suppose if we could cast it, maybe we would. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Introduction to bones. Okay, well, you probably are learning some of this terminology. So here's chapter 7. You're probably learning some of this terminology in lab already. You haven't had a practicum on this, maybe some quizzes or something. Okay, well, let's just go over some landmarks. So these are all new words to you, unless you've covered them in lab already. A raised rough spot on a bone is used for a muscle attachment. And there's some dense, regular connective tissue that attaches muscle to bone, and we commonly call that a... What's a dense, regular connective tissue that attaches muscle to bone? We haven't really talked about muscle in here yet. But you know dense, regular connective tissue with bone-to-bone connection. What's that? That's a ligament, but a muscle to bone is what we call a tendon. Exactly the same kind of tissue. What kind of cells are in that tendon? I threw you a curveball. That's a fibroblast, right? Laying down collagen. All right, so that tendon is pulling on a bone, and when it's what happens to that bone when something's pulling on it in that one location? It's going to hypertrophy. It's going to get stronger. We're going to have increased bone deposition. It's going to get stronger because why? You're exercising the bone at that location. And so it's going to get bigger and thicker. It's going to form a bump, and it's going to have all kinds of attachment points to that tendon, right? And so it's going to be a rough area. It's going to be a rough raised area on a bone because you're exercising it. And the more you exercise, the bigger the bone gets. And that could become a crest, for instance, right? So here are the names of rough raised areas on bones. And typically we call those processes. So any kind of rough raised area on a bone is a process, but they could have other kinds of names as well. But all these other terms are still processes. For instance, a tubercle. That's a process, but it's a rough raised area on a bone for what's the function? What's the function of a tubercle? Or what's the function of a process? It's for, I could say it in two words, real easy, it's for muscle attachment. Right? Muscle attachment. But don't forget, ligaments will cause these rough raised areas as well. So if anybody ever asks you, what's the function of this process right here, you just, without thinking, what are you going to say? Muscle attachment. And you're going to be mostly right all the time. Okay. So another name besides tubercle is a tuberosity. And a tuberosity is a little bit larger tubercle. So I have these graded or ranked by size. So what's a function of a tuberosity? Muscle attachment. Without thinking, just say muscle attachment. All right, and a trochanter is a tuberosity, but it's like a big one. It's a grande tuberosity. All right, so what's the function of this trochanter? Muscle attachment. Yeah, okay. Epicondyle, malleolus. The malleolus are the bumps in your ankle. And what's the function of malleolus? Muscle attachment, okay? But in your ankle, you know, you have a lot of ligaments as well. There's a lot of ligament attachments there. Yeah?
Malleolus? Is that one type process, though? Is that like...
Yeah, it's a special kind of process that's in your ankle. See these little bony things right here? Well, you can't. You see them. But if I were to take my socks off, you could see them. Okay? All right, and a crest is... a raised, rough, bony prominence on a bone, but it's what? It's really raised over a long extension, over a long space, right? So a crest is just a long, not just a dot or a simple formation. It's a long process. And a spine? A spine is, again, sort of like a crest, but it's smaller. It might be more narrow. It might be more like a pinpoint or something. That could be a spine. And a line is a raised area that is what? Very long and narrow and not maybe very tall. It's just something that maybe you could palpate with your fingertips or you could see with your naked eye, but it's not going to be a huge, big, bony prominence. But nonetheless, what's that function of the line on a bone? Muscle attachment. Okay? Because it's what? It's a process for muscle attachment. Okay. Another kind of feature on a bone is a depression. And a depression is a bowl. And what do bowls do? They hold stuff, right? So all of these things, the function, you should always, right, try to know the function of something in anatomy, right? Because there's always structural functional relationships. All right, some things are fossa. A fossa is a bowl that holds something. You have fossas in your cranium that hold your, like your, yeah, maybe your eyes, but your brain, for instance. Okay, we have different fossas. A sulcus is a depression that's a little bit longer than just a bowl, so it's going to be a stretched out fossa, but its function is for holding something. Maybe a blood vessel is coursing very close to a bone and makes a little depression, a long depression in a bone. And a groove, again, is a depression that's a little bit longer, than it is wide and deep. And an alveolus, first time you've run into this term, an alveolus is more like a pocket inside of a bone. And we don't have too many alveoli. The little pocket that our eyeball sits in right there, I suppose you could consider that an alveolus, but we don't ever call it that. We just call that an orbit. But the little sockets that our teeth fit into in our lower jaw and upper jaw, those little sockets are called alveoli. All right, so what's the function of an alveolus? It holds something. And in particular, you could say a tooth. It's holding a tooth, right? The root of a tooth in there. All right, so alveolus is singular. Alveoli is plural. And a hole in a bone has a number of different names. The typical one you've heard of probably is foramen. And there's another one called a meatus, like your external auditory meatus. It's kind of a pocket, but it's kind of longer than just a pocket. It doesn't go all the way through to your brain. It stops before it gets there. All right, and so you have an internal meatus and an external meatus, and you've got the petrous region of the temporal bone separating the two meati so that you don't really have air going right into your brain, which is a good thing. But you have some important organs in that region in the temporal bone. So meatus and a canal sometimes are used interchangeably. So a canal is what? A really long hole in a bone. It's like a tunnel going through a bone, not just a small hole.
Part of the canal would start at the top.
A canal is just, well, if you have a flat bone and there's just a little hole in it, you might call that a foramen. But if it's a thicker bone and that hole has to be stretched out to get through the bone, then you maybe would call that a canal. So that's really the difference between a foramen and a canal. Yeah.
The middle ear is inside
the petrous region of the temporal bone, and the middle ear is separating the external auditory meatus with the internal auditory meatus, and that's right in that petrous region of the temporal bone. And if you haven't seen that in lab, you will real soon. Okay. Okay. A fissure is just a long hole in a bone that's stretched out, so it's like a crack in the bone, but not really a crack. But what's the function of a fissure in a bone? It's a passageway. That's exactly right. For instance, for blood vessels, for nerves, maybe even for muscles that have to go from one side of the bone to the other. And a sinus, all right? Sinus is a hole in a bone, but it's not really a passageway necessarily. It's just a big hole in the bone. A cavity could be like the medullary cavity, but there are some special sinuses, for instance, in cranial bones or facial bones that are hollowed out, like, for instance, the maxilla. And these are what we call the paranasal sinuses. And did you learn it? Anybody learn in lab where these paranasal sinuses are? What bones? I said one. I gave you the maxilla down over here. Sphenoid, which is kind of right smack in the middle of your head, that's two. Ethmoid, which is on the top of your nose over here. And then your frontal bone also has a paranasal sinus. And the function of the paranasal sinuses is not really passageway. They are open to the outside world, but they're filled with lymphatic tissue. So what the heck does lymphatic tissue do? Does anybody have a clue for what lymphatic tissue? Your appendix is lymphatic tissue. Your lymph nodes are lymphatic tissue. Your tonsils are lymphatic tissue. And lymphatic tissue, it fights infection. Right. So the paranasal sinuses help fight infection because that's how a lot of things gain entry to your body, is through your nose, right? Because you're breathing in air all the time, and air is certainly not sterile. It's loaded with bacteria and fungus and stuff like that. So the paranasal sinuses help prevent against infection. Some lymphatic tissues can be chronically infected, and like tonsils can. And so if they're fighting an infection that never really clears up, then the sinuses might start to plug up, and they might be draining mucus all the time, and it might give you headaches because you'll feel pressure and stuff like that. And sometimes a really long and strong course of antibiotics would help. But since that infection is not inside your body, it's really outside your body, it's difficult to treat because you don't have blood going to the inside of that sinus right there. So sometimes people have to actually go in and like do a little Roto-Rooter action and remove that tissue. Okay? And hopefully that cures the problem after that. I don't know what that process is called, the name of going in and removing the sinus tissue. Yeah, then it can heal back on itself and then the inflammation goes away. But your sinuses can get filled with fluid, and when you have a sinus infection, your voice sounds different, and I'm sure you feel different too, right? Yeah. Okay. All right, a fourth kind of functional space or object on bones is a smooth articulating surface. And this is between bones that are going to form a joint, because bones that form a joint have motion, right? And bones are made out of hydroxyapatite, which is like a rock, and if you grind a couple rocks on each other, what's going to happen to the rocks? They're going to grind down, right? And you don't want that to happen to your bones. That's a pathophysiologic condition. What do we call that when bones are grinding each other down? That's arthritis, right? Different kinds of arthritis. So bones should be protected on these articulating surfaces. What kind of material protects a joint surface so that the bones don't actually touch each other? Hyaline cartilage, right? Hyaline cartilage or articular cartilage. But nonetheless, those articulating surfaces should be very smooth. And in lab, you should be able to feel all those articulating surfaces with your fingertip, because they're not going to feel like a process, which is rough. They're going to feel like maybe a little bit of a depression or a dome, which is smooth. All right, so there are some smooth surfaces which are called condyles. This is a raised area, but it's not rough. You have the head of a bone. This might be a raised surface with a dimple in it as well. That's the head. And a facet is always a depression in a bone for an articulation. And if you put your finger in that facet and rub back and forth, how should that feel? Smooth, right? Smooth. All the bones that we have in lab certainly don't have hyaline cartilage on them anymore, but nonetheless, the structure of that joint is still, you still should feel it as smooth. All right, and trochlea. That's a special kind of articulating surface. All right, and also capitulum is another one. I could put that there. How do you spell that? Let me put it in. Capitulum. Oh, not S. Control S. There. Capitulum. So you're going to run into these. So what's the function of this trochlea? It forms a joint. It's for joints. Right? So bones don't grind each other down. Okay, then one last thing. There's a couple places in your body where a bone forms an angle, a nice right angle, and that right angle is what we call a ramus. And you probably might be familiar with one already, like for instance your jawbone. Comes down from your temporomandibular joint, comes down, and then courses anteriorly. That forms a nice right angle joint. That part that reaches up to the TMJ joint is called the mandibular ramus. Okay, and you'll run into a ramus now and again in the class. Okay, the skeleton. Let's see. The skeleton, actually I think we have some nice pictures of this someplace. Oh, what chapter is this? 7? Okay. Okay, so here's a nice picture that shows the skeleton. And we can generally break the skeleton down into two parts. And they're nicely color-coded. This purple area right here, green? Okay. This green area right here is what we call the axial skeleton. Right? And so the axial skeleton, parts of it are really easy to see, are made up of all the bones of the head, as well as the vertebral column, and face, So cranial bones and facial bones, head bones, that's part of the axial skeleton. All right, and bones that protect the thorax, namely the sternum right here and all the ribs. And don't forget that the sacrum right here and coccyx, that's really kind of a part of your vertebral column. So bones of the head and the vertebral column and thoracic cage make the axial skeleton. And there's one other bone that I don't see in here that makes the axial skeleton. There's a bone that not many people know about unless you study anatomy, and it's deep to the mandible, and that is? Oh, it is on there? Do you see it someplace? It should be right in here. It's the hyoid bone. I can't see it. It might be on the slide. Okay. It is part of the axial skeleton. And you could maybe palpate the hyoid bone. It's kind of a horseshoe-shaped bone. It's very thin and dainty. It's surrounded by a lot of muscle. I probably wouldn't try to feel it because it's so dainty that if you go poking around in there past all those muscles, you can even break it. So I wouldn't try to feel it. But go and find the skeleton. You'll see it on the skeleton in lab, the hyoid bone. It looks like a little fetal mandible. All right, so that's the axial. All the other bones are what we call, make up the appendicular skeleton, skeleton of the appendage. So that includes the upper appendage and the lower appendage right here, plus bones that attach the appendages to the axial skeleton. And those have a special designation. All right, there are bones that attach the upper appendage to the axial skeleton. That would be the clavicle and scapula. And the bones that attach the lower appendage to the axial skeleton would be the ascoxae right here, or the hip bones, or pelvic bones, ascoxae. So that's pretty much the whole skeleton. And you have to know everything on this slide. Okay. All right? This is not a bad slide. This is like as easy a picture as you'll get in anatomy, probably. Okay. So let's talk about the, in particular, axial skeleton. I put these numbers right here just for give you a little feel for how many bones are in the skull, but I would never test you on how many bones make up the axial skeleton or how many bones make up the whole skeleton. That's not too important to me. Oh, there's that hyoid bone right here. But it's just sort of interesting. If we did some comparative anatomy, that would be interesting. If we were to compare the cat with the human or the horse with the human, that would be really interesting. Maybe you'd have to memorize that in a comparative anatomy class, but not this one. Okay, so skull bones. Skull can be broken down into a couple different kinds of bones. There are bones that make up the brain case, and we call those cranial bones. These are bones that are going to be holding the brain in position. All right, and so that forms a single unit, and so we've got these right here, parietal, temporal, ethmoid, occipital, sphenoid, frontal. We have some that are not really included in this list. These are wormy bones. Sometimes we call these sutural bones. Now, what the heck is a suture? It's a kind of joint. A suture is, it's a separation of bones that make up the cranium. Okay, and even bones that make up the face as well. They're separated by sutures. So sutures are not very movable. Right, so joints between bones that form the cranium, you don't see anybody's cranium really moving back and forth when they're thinking, like in a science fiction movie. Right, so these joints are very stable. We'll learn what kind of joints those are. And every once in a while, there'll be a bone within that joint. It's not in a tendon or within a ligament, but it's within a suture. And a suture kind of looks like a what? Kind of looks like a worm. Okay, it's very wormy in nature, so sometimes we call those wormian bones. I don't know if your book says wormian bones, but probably a better term would be sutural bone. It's a bone within a suture, just a little tiny bone fragment. Okay, and then we have a number of facial bones that we have to know. All right, and then we have six other bones that are important for hearing. And these bones are within the temporal bone. Where's temporal bone? Right there. Within the temporal bone, in particular the petrous region of the temporal bone, and you have three on each side of your head, and I could say that I am holding all three. Actually, I could say I'm holding all six right here between my fingers. And guess what? You would have to believe me. You couldn't challenge me because the bones are so small that they would all fit between my fingertips like this, and you couldn't see them anyway. That's how small they are. okay, because they're inside your middle ear. Okay. All right, so let's look at some of these bones. Oh, wait, over here. All right, so here's a nice frontal view. You should probably be aware of what bones make up the orbital cavity right here, which bones make up the nasal cavity. I think that's a homework assignment. Okay, so I didn't publish the answer key yet, but you could look at the, I'll probably maybe do that tonight. All right, so here's a hole in a bone. What's a hole in a bone called? Foramen, right? This might be a foramen. It might be eroded away to where it's just a little notch in the bone right here. All right, so what bones do I see? Frontal bone. Now, if you're going to really study a lot in a class to prepare for later on in the course, knowing bones is really, really helpful. It's going to seem really easy, I think. It might come to you pretty easy, but I would really learn bones, because when you learn a bone, you're going to learn a lot of vascular anatomy. You're going to learn a lot of neuroanatomy. So just by knowing bones, automatically, you're going to know so many other names in your body. So for instance, your brain has different lobes, a number of different lobes. And guess what lobe is deep to the frontal bone? That is the frontal lobe. So that's immediately going to save a lot of study time later on in the class. Okay? Okay. The parietal lobe is posterior to the frontal lobe. Guess what lobe of the brain is in this region right here? That's the parietal lobe, right? So make sure you know your bones really well, because it will just reinforce and make learning everything else in the class very easy. Okay. All right, so here is the mandible. That's your lower jawbone. Your upper jawbone is the maxilla, and it has a nice paranasal sinus in there as well. The maxilla helps make up the nasal cavity and even makes this inferior margin of the orbit right here. Bridge of the nose are the nasal bones. And this right here is what we call the nasal cavity, but the nasal cavity is just not one space. It's actually two spaces. It's separated by something. And in anatomy, that separation we usually call a septum. So your heart has a number of chambers in it, and your heart is separated by septa as well. Okay? Not bony septa like in the nose, but separations, different walls. So the nasal septum right here has got two bones. The inferior part is made out of the vomer, and the superior part is made out of the ethmoid bone. And I can tell you what my favorite bone in the whole body is right now, and that is the ethmoid bone. And that might be somebody's favorite here too, because it has a lot of function, and we're going to talk about the function of the ethmoid bone. It has a lot of different functions, but one function automatically you know now is that the ethmoid bone does what? It helps make up the nasal septum, right? And the nasal septum is important because it helps guide air into our lungs so that there's not a lot of turbulence. It helps humidify the air so that we don't turn our lungs into potato chips, cools the air down when it's hot, warms the air up, right, if it's cold outside. So the ethmoid bone, at least in those ways, is pretty important. Okay, so here is the ethmoid bone. What else do we see on this slide? There's a bone that is remarkable because it goes all the way transversely across the head from right to left. Right, and probably if you can see colors, you can even see it. It helps make up the orbits as well. That's the sphenoid bone. And the sphenoid bone is, you know, if you put your fingers, which we commonly call the temporal region right here, that's really not the temporal bone, that's the sphenoid bone right here. That's the sphenoid. Right, and posterior to the sphenoid is the temporal. I don't know if we can see that. You can see maybe a little bit of a temporal bone right over here. But the temporal bone is not in the temporal region. It's what? More above your ears. So that's a temporal bone over here. All right, so you'll have to know what these bones look like even when they're disarticulated from each other, because you'll really understand how the skull gets put together if you can appreciate the individual structure or form of all of the facial bones and cranial bones. Okay, so here is a suture. So here's a lambdoidal suture, and the lambdoidal suture separates the parietal from the occipital bone. And there is a sagittal suture that separates the two parietal bones, and this is where you would find wormian bones. So wormian bones, probably the most common location would be in the lambdoid suture, in this location right here. All right, so here's a nice lateral view of the head. So you can see the major bones that make up the cranium, frontal bone, parietal bone, occipital is all the way in the back. And then between the parietal and occipital, here's the temporal bone. And here again is the sphenoid, which is a little bit anterior to the sphenoid. And the mandible, maxilla. And between the maxilla and the temporal bone, that's a cheekbone. And that's called the zygomatic bone. It's kind of triangular shaped. It's actually pretty small when you look at it, but it's pretty easy to recognize. Okay, we see the nasal bone. Now the bone, a bone that I haven't mentioned so far, is a very, very thin bone. It's a lacrimal bone right here, and it contains a little depression or a foramen that allows tears to drain from your eye, from an orbit into your nose. That's a lacrimal fossa right there with the little lacrimal foramen. Alright, so this I'm sure is an exam figure, so not only do you have to know the names of the bones, but all these pieces of the bones as well. So here is the styloid process. What's the function of the styloid process? Oh, without thinking, you should just say muscle attachment. And indeed, you would be right. All right, here is the mastoid process. What's the function of that mastoid process? Muscle attachment. So again, if you learn the bones really well, when we get to muscles, it's just going to make your life so much easier because you'll have a picture in your head of where all these muscles attach to automatically. So spend a lot of nice time in lab and in your textbook. And next time, remind me to show you a flash quiz on head bones of the head, cranial bones and facial bones. And it's on the website if you want to preview it already. Oh, I didn't have a sign-in sheet today. Sorry about that. How about right now? You have time? Good.